Now, today, what we're going to do is finish talking about the Maccabean Revolt, or actually, we're just going to start talking about the Revolt and the story of Hanukkah. And depending on how much time we have, we're going to talk about the Romans. Just a little bit of review. Remember, we're talking about Hanukkah is, first and foremost, is an ideological war. Okay, it's history's first religious ideological war. Right? No one in the ancient world died for their gods. It's a uniquely Jewish trait. Okay, we taught the world the idea of martyrdom again. And that's what the story of Hanukkah is all about. The threat of the Greeks and their Jewish allies, remember, another big important part of the holiday. It's as much a civil war as it is an external threat. The threat of the Hellenized Jews and their Greek allies was against Judaism, not the Jewish people. They didn't decree an end to the Jewish people, but they decreed rather that the Jews should stop practicing Judaism. And the Jewish reaction, as we mentioned before, was the vast majority of Jews who were loyal to the rabbis and loyal to Torah head for the hills and secretly practiced Judaism. They're hunted down by the Greeks. And we're going to see again that the opposition to the Greek decrees against Torah and Judaism is going to come from this family called the Hasmoneans, who are going to be called the Hasmoneans, led by, as I mentioned, the end of the last class, a guy by the name of Yochanan. It says Matthias ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol, Mattathias the son of Yochanan the high priest, and his five sons, who are going to be named the Maccabees. And if you want their names, it's Yehuda, Elazar, Yochanan, Yonatan, and Simon, Shimon. Okay? Okay? Most of whom we're going to see are going to die in the fighting or not too long afterwards. The Hasmoneans are actually great tragic figures in Jewish history. Okay, a little bit about the actual events. Now again, if you want to read the details of the Maccabean story, you read in the first and second Maccabees, books that are not in the Jewish Bible. You can get it, the Christian Bible has them. You can also buy a copy of a book called Sefer HaChitzonim, which is a whole collection of different writings that were not included in the Jewish Bible, but are nonetheless very, very interesting. It's a two-volume book in Hebrew. I don't know if it's in English. You guys just have to work on your Hebrew a little more. Now, I want to go over a little bit of the overview of what's going on. I'm going to read you, I normally don't read long quotes here, but I want to read you a whole section from the Book of the Maccabees. So you can hear, the Book of the Maccabees is actually considered to be, we don't know exactly who wrote it, it's written in Hebrew. It's considered to be like the Royal Chronicles, like, you know, basically the Hasmonean family, it's going to end up ruling Israel, the Maccabean descendants, are going to commission someone to write an account of the period of time. That's what becomes known as the Book of the Maccabees. So after I go through a little bit of the outline, I'm going to go back and read you through how the authors are talking about, not pretty soon after the events, are going to describe what happens in the story of the Maccabees. Okay. Again, keep in mind we're around the year 167. It's during the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes, the Seleucid Assyrian Greek ruler who's ruling over Israel. The decrees are launched against the Jewish people, and the Jewish people revolt. The revolt begins in a place called Modi'in. If you take the back road to Jerusalem today, via what's called the Ben Shemin interchange, it's off parallel to the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv highway, you'll come to a place called Modi'in. There's a moshav there today. There's a religious moshav there. Moshav is sort of like a communal living arrangement, similar but not exactly like a kibbutz. Okay, what's the plot? The plot is, again, the Greeks show up in this town of Modi'in. They demand that a Jew sacrifice a pig to the Greek gods. And they find a... We've got to compete with the Islam's greatest hits outside now. They find a Hellenized Jew who is willing to... You want to close the window? Yeah. A Hellenized Jew who is willing to do so. And just as he's about to do the dastardly deed, the senior Mr. Maccabee, okay, Mattathias, steps out of the crowd, stabs the Jew, kills the Greek, and then he basically says, "Who is for God? Follow me." And all of the Jews who realize that the Greeks are going to come back and wipe out the whole village now as a reprisal, they all head for the hills. And they organize a guerrilla army, led primarily by the oldest of the sons. His name is Yehuda, Judah Maccabee. He's going to assume the role initially as military leader. He's also going to be killed later. He's going to be surrounded and killed at a later battle. But initially, he is the leader. He is the guy who really gets the title Maccabee. And as I mentioned before, Maccabee is an acronym for Mi Kamocha Belim Hashem, who is like you amongst the powers, O God. This is sort of like the battle cry of the Jewish people. God is it. Not Coca-Cola here, right? God is it. Okay. And the Jews organize a small army. We're talking about small meaning the largest Maccabean armies ever fielded. We don't know. We're talking about in the thousands, you know, maybe 10,000 men, absolute largest, 12, who knows, that's like probably way too many, fighting Greek armies of 10 to 40,000 men. Greeks outnumbering Jews sometimes over 4 to 1. Okay? And not only, it's not just a numerical superiority the Greeks have. The Greeks are professional soldiers. They have these phalanx, right? They have these big spears and the armor. They're trained soldiers. They have tanks. Tanks from that period of time are elephants, war elephants, something introduced by the Persians. That's what Alexander the Great had to come up against when he was conquering the Persian Empire. The Greeks adopt that into their army. So it's talking about a vastly outnumbered, poorly trained, poorly equipped Jewish force fighting a much better equipped, much better trained, much larger Greek forces. Now, the story of the battles are very interesting. Most of the battles take place in the area between here, Jerusalem, and Tel Aviv. If you go along the road, the parallel road, I live on that road, it's the road that goes from Ramot to right before the Tel Aviv, the airport in Ben-Gurion, which is the Ben-Shemin interchange there going by Modi'in, the new town, which is also named after the biblical place, Modi'in, or the time of the Maccabees, Modi'in. Many of the battles take place in that area. It's a place called Beit Horon. Why are they taking place in that area, the battles? Because what the Greeks are trying to do is march their armies up the natural wadis, the natural entrances into the mountains. If you live in a mountainous area, there's only a certain number of places, like in Israel, there are a couple of key places that if you're coming from across the Jordan River that you can enter. If you go on the Jericho Road, the road that goes down to the Dead Sea, that's a natural valley there, which is a place where throughout history people would ascend. There's only a few of those places. So at the key junctures where armies would try and ascend to Jerusalem, this is where Yehuda Maccabee chooses, and his armies choose to make their stand. If you want to read about the history, the key battles are Lavona, Beit Horon, Emmaus. Okay, there's a couple of very, very significant battles that, without going into the details, where the Jews, using superior tactics and obviously superior courage, especially on the part of their leaders, are able to defeat much larger Greek armies. Now, we read the story of the Maccabees, it seems like it's something that takes place over a few weeks. Okay? The battles take place, the Jews win, and the Greeks go home. We have to understand the story of the Maccabees takes place over about 25 years of fighting. Okay? After the first 3 years, Judah Maccabee and his followers, they're able to reconquer Jerusalem, which was made into, the temple was defiled, it was made into a pagan sanctuary, right? They were offering pigs up there on the altar, the ultimate affront to the Jewish God. Jerusalem is liberated, okay? The temple is cleaned out and rededicated, okay? And now we have the miracle. They didn't find any oil to put in the menorah in the temple. They found one little vial of undefiled oil, and it burned for 8 days instead of 1 day, and it's a big miracle. I'm going to read you now in the book of the Maccabees. You'll see that miracle is not mentioned at all. And we'll talk a little bit afterwards about why the oil is so significant. But after 3 years, Yehuda and his forces reconquer Jerusalem, right? Rededicate the temple. The Greeks are able to reconquer Jerusalem from the Jews. The Jews have to reconquer it again. It's going to take a very long time. It's going to take about 142 or so BCE, during the reign of Demetrius, the Seleucid king, that he finally is going to make a peace treaty with the Jews, cessation of hostilities. Which does not mean, of course, that the Jews rid the land of Israel of Greek influence. They don't. Okay, the Greeks are always going to remain there. As a matter of fact, it says a stronghold up probably somewhere, we're not sure where it was, near the Antonia Fortress, which is somewhere on the area of the Temple Mount. There was a stronghold which the Greeks occupied for a very long period of time, even after the Jews had more or less controlled the city. So we're not talking about a clear-cut battle. We're talking about a very long, protracted struggle in which a lot of people died. Okay, lots of Jews died. Lots of Greeks died. Very bloody. Okay, but we have to remember it's a physical struggle for spiritual victory. I want to read you a little bit. It's a little bit long, but it's very interesting. This is from Maccabees 1 through 4. Okay, the Maccabean Uprising. Again, this is written somewhere around 100 BCE, which is not too long after the events take place, during the time when the descendants of the original Maccabees, the Hasmonean family as they'll be known, the Hashmonaim, who become the ruling family of Israel. If you look on your little timelines here, you have Hasmoneans, 103 years. Going to be 11 different Hasmoneans who are going to rule. During that period of time, they're going to commission a royal chronicler to write about the events of the past. Yes, sir?
You said this is only in Hebrew. Where
is the translation from? You can buy translations of the Book of the Maccabees. This I'm taking, if you want, I'm taking what I'm reading you from now is an excellent, excellent, excellent book. It's called Texts and Traditions, Second Temple Period. It goes through a lot of the major historical events of the Second Temple period, brings in, it has a narrative along with a lot of historical documentation that's bringing in. I don't know who translated this exactly here, though. it says, all the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. Many even from Israel gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed their idols and profaned the Sabbath. And the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah, and he directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid the burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane the Sabbath and feasts, and to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable by everything unclean and profane, so that they should forget the law and change all the ordinances. And, quote, and whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die. Okay, this is what the king Antiochus Epiphanes is up to. In such words, he wrote to his whole kingdom, and he appointed inspectors over all the people and commanded the cities of Judah to offer sacrifices city by city. Many of the people, everyone who forsook the law, joined them, and they did evil in the land, and they drove Israel into hiding in every place of refuge they had. Now, on the 15th day of Kislev, in the 145th year, we're talking about of the temple here, the rebuilding of the second temple is the date they're using. I think that's what they're using. Okay, many of the people, here it is. Now, in the 15th of the day of Kislev, on the 145th year, okay, they erected a desolating sacrilege upon the altar of the burnt offerings. They also built altars in the surrounding cities of Judah, and they burnt incense at the doors of the houses and in the streets. The books of the law which they found, they tore to pieces and burnt with fire. Where the book of the covenant, which the Torah was found in possession of anyone, or anyone adhered to the law, the decree of the king condemned him to death. They kept using violence against Israel, against those who found month after month in cities. On the 25th day of the month, they offered sacrifices on the altar, which was upon the altar burnt offering. According to the decree, they put to death the woman who had their children circumcised, and their families, and those who circumcised them, and they hung the infants from their mothers' necks. This is, they would kill kids who were circumcised, and they'd hang the dead bodies from the necks of their mothers, who they also killed. But many in Israel stood firm and were resolved in their hearts not to eat unclean food. They chose to die rather than to be defiled by the food or to profane the holy covenant, and they did die. And very great wrath came upon Israel. In those days, Mattathias, the son of John, this is a Christianized translation here, son of Simon, the priest of the sons of Yorib, moved from Jerusalem and settled in Modi'in. He had five sons, John, surnamed Gadi, Simon called Tasi, Judas called Maccabeus, Eliezer called Avaran, and Jonathan called Apphus. He saw the blasphemies being committed in Judah and Jerusalem. And Mattathias and his sons rent their clothes, put on sackcloth, and mourned greatly. Then the king's officers, who were enforcing the apostasy, came to the city of Modi'in to make them offer sacrifices. Many from Israel came to them, and Mattathias and his sons were assembled. Then the king's officers spoke to Mattathias as follows: "You are leaders honored and great in the city, and supported by your sons and brothers." Now be the first to come and do what the king commands, as all the Gentiles and the men of Judah and those that are left in Jerusalem have done. Then you and your sons will be numbered among the friends of the king, and you and your sons will be honored with silver and gold and many gifts. But Mattathias answered and said in a loud voice, "Even if all the nations that lived under the rule of the king obey him, and have chosen to do his commandments, departing each from the religion of his fathers, yet I and my sons and my brothers will live by the covenant of our fathers. Far be it from us to desert the law and the ordinances. We will not obey the king's word by turning aside from our religion to the right hand nor to the left." When he had finished speaking these words, a Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifices upon the altar in Modi'in, according to the king's commandment. When Mattathias saw it, he burned with zeal, and his heart was stirred. He gave vent to his righteous anger. He ran and killed him upon the altar. And at the same time, he killed the king's officers who were forcing him to sacrifice, and he tore down the altar. Then Mattathias cried out in the city with a loud voice, saying, "Let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come up with me." And he and his sons fled to the hills and left all that they had in the city. The many who were seeking righteousness and justice went down to the wilderness to dwell there, they and their sons, their wives and cattle, because evil pressed heavily upon them. And he goes on and on, and it talks about all the battles and who was killed, and I think it gets a pretty good description of what's going on here. I want to just read the last little part here. It's talking about the rededication of the temple. And I want to talk about what's the message behind Hanukkah. So this is from Maccabees 4 through 6 also. This is after Jerusalem has been captured. "Then said Judas and his brothers, 'Behold, our enemies are crushed. Let us go and cleanse the sanctuary and dedicate it.' So all the armies assembled and went up to Mount Zion." We're talking about here. Okay, not Zion. Mount Zion is Mount Moriah. And they saw the sanctuary desolate and the altar profaned and the gates burned. In the courts they saw bushes sprung up in the thicket and as on one of the mountains. They also saw the chambers of the priests in ruins. Then they rent their clothes and mourned with great lamentation and sprinkled themselves with ashes. They fell face down on the ground and sounded the signal on the trumpets and cried out to heaven. Then Judas detailed men to fight against those in the citadel until he had cleansed the sanctuary. Blah, 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 blah. And they go on to describe reconquering. And then he says, early in the morning on the 25th day of the ninth month, which is the month of Kislev, in the 148th year, they rose and offered sacrifices as the Lord directs on the new altar of burnt offerings which they had built. And the very season on that very day that the Gentiles had profaned it. And it was dedicated with songs and harps and lutes and cymbals. And all the people fell on their faces and worshipped and blessed heaven who had prospered them. So they celebrated the dedication of the altar for 8 days and offered burnt offerings with gladness. They offered a sacrifice of deliverance and praise. And the last thing it says, and Judas and his brothers and all the assembly of Israel determined that every year at that season, the days of the dedication of the altar should be observed with gladness and joy for 8 days, beginning with the 25th day of the month of Kislev. Okay, so there I ran through. There's a lot more. You can read that. I'll read the whole book of Maccabees to you. But the question, hold on 1 second. What is missing from that story about the end of dedication? Right, the miracle of the oil is not there. Okay, it's not there. Okay, the question is, why not? Okay, by the way, if you do the prayers on Hanukkah, you read the Al Hanisim prayers, we read, you'll see, in a few days, we have Hanukkah. We're going to read, we add in to both the blessing, the Birkat HaMazon, the blessing after the meal, and three times a day, and we daven, it's going to say Al Hanisim, Velaporkan, on the miracles, right, and all the redemption, and so on. And then it's going to talk about in the days of Matthias ben Yochanan Cohen Gadol, when the Greeks rose up and they did horrible things, and God delivered the many into the hands of the few, and the evil into the hands of the good, and the wicked into the hands of the righteous, and the impure into the hands of the pure. And they sanctified the altar, and we have this 8 days of Hanukkah. If you read in Al Hanisim, also the miracle of the oil is not mentioned either. It's not mentioned there, it's not mentioned in the story. The question is, why not? We make such a big deal out of this light stuff. The point is not that we're saying it didn't happen, but think about it. I mean, a lamp burning for 8 days instead of 1 day is hardly the most awesome miracle in Jewish history. Okay, much cooler is splitting of Red Sea, firstborn of Egyptian dropping dead, all kinds of cool miracles happen in the Bible. In the grand list of miracles, this is about as low as it gets. No, seriously, it's not something so amazing. But it's more important what it is symbolic of. The real miracle of Hanukkah, as we see in the prayers, is the military victory of a few Jews over the mighty Greek Empire. Okay, that's the real miracle going on here. Just like Israel in 67, little Israel beats off all of the surrounding Arabs. That's the real miracle. Okay, but, hold on 1 second, Max. Wait 1 second. We'll get to you. The point is remember the point of Hanukkah, it's a spiritual threat. The Greeks, for all the beauty that the Bible talks about, Greek and everything, Greek is described as dark. Okay, the darkness that is Greece. It's not by chance that Hanukkah takes place at the time when the days of the year are the shortest, right? In the December season, right? Because that represents the time when there's the least light and the most darkness, just as the Greeks represented the ultimate form of threat to the Jewish people. Not a spiritual threat, not a physical threat, but a spiritual threat. Light is synonymous with Torah and with the soul of a man. Okay, that's a very common idea and motif in Jewish thinking. Right? Ki ner Hashem nishmat Adam. Right, because the candle of a man is the soul of God. Okay, the Torah, light, Eish HaTorah. Right, the Greeks threatened to snuff out through their ideology that which was Torah, not a physical destruction, a spiritual destruction. We triumphed. Our triumph was not just a physical triumph at incredible odds, but a spiritual victory. And that victory gave us the strength throughout human history to stand up against people who were much mightier than us that also wanted to destroy our religion. That's why we make such a big deal about the oil. Okay, because that's what we have to focus on. Hanukkah has been turned into in modern Zionist ideology. It's obviously a holiday that's going to be very big. We study Zionism again, we'll see why they're so big into this ideology, why Judah Maccabee is so glorified. Because it's the notion of the Jews who fought, the Jews who didn't roll over, who weren't slaughtered, who weren't sent like sheep to the slaughter, but died fighting. These macho guys, like right? Elazar and Judah and all these people. Okay? But the reality is, you have to keep in mind that the real victory is the spiritual victory. That's the essence of the holiday. You had a question, Max?
Oh, I guess, you kind of touched it because you said it was, I thought at first I heard you say that it was a military, this incredible military victory, which is what you would read in the Maccabees, but then in rabbinical, rabbis point out the fact of the spiritual is that the...
No, actually the rabbis talking about the military victory. It's not talking about the spiritual thing. They don't make a big meal out of the miraculous miracle of the oil.
What about that quote with the... I think it goes, it ends up with, but by my might, saith the Lord, but by my power.
Right.
In other words, emphasizing God...
Oh yeah, for sure. No, this is. But you see, the chroniclers in the book of the Maccabees say the same thing. They're talking about how this is a spiritual attack against the Jews. They don't make it a macho thing. They talk about the valorous deeds of the Hasmoneans because he's the chronicler of that dynasty. But even the chronicler at that period of time is clearly emphasizing that the struggle is a spiritual struggle, and the Jews are being, as we say, moser nefesh, giving their lives for their ideology. Okay, it's very clear from the narrative, from our traditional understanding, from the book of the Maccabees, that's what's going on. So that's the victory of it. So they made it. This is one of, again, two rabbinic holidays that are added. And we already saw the first, which is the holiday of Purim, which takes place much earlier in Babylon, the only holiday that takes place outside the land of Israel. This is the second. And although the book is not included in the Bible, unlike the Megillat Esther, the book of Esther, which is included in the Jewish Bible, it is still an incredibly significant holiday because there's an opportunity there. It's not just a significant... Again, no Jewish holiday is merely a commemoration of a historical event, as great as that event may or may not be. This is a great event in Jewish history. Rather, it is focusing us in on the power of the Jewish people, which we can tap into in times of tremendous need, and our ability to withstand even the greatest physical and spiritual threats. And we have to keep in mind, by the way, the Greeks, again, this ambivalent relationship that we have with the Greeks, it's going to remain throughout. It's very old. It goes way before the story of the Maccabees, and it's with us at all times, this interrelationship between Jews and Greeks. It's a constant struggle. Okay, it's going all the way back, sorry?
We're
going to get that story in a minute. We're going to talk about the elephants being killed and everything. Hold on one second. Going all the way back in the Bible to the story of Noah giving his sons blessings, Shem, Ham, the Yafet, we say traditionally Yafet, which is related to the word Yofi, beauty. We say the descendants of Yafet, the Greeks, right? Shem, the descendants of Shem, Middle Eastern peoples, the Jews come from Shem. When Noah is blessing Yafet, he says, Yiftach Hashem v'Yafet v'Yishkan v'Ochel Hashem. Right? That Yafet should spread out, but Yafet should dwell in the tents of Shem. That the external, that which is so beautiful in Greek culture, their ability to understand the physical world and their appreciation of beauty, which is manifest in not only their architectural things, but in their language, all of that has a place in the world. But it has to dwell in the tents of Shem. It has to be grounded in that which is Judaism, the internalness of Judaism. Otherwise, you get a totally superficial view of the world, an external view of the world, which is Greece. So the two of them combined is, in many ways, an ideal. Okay? So it's not just a clear-cut Greek evil. Okay? It's Greece out of control is bad news. When Greek ideology fights with Jewish ideology, it's bad news. By the way, the ultimate Greek product, I'm not saying it's far from perfect, but anyone know what the ultimate Greek product is in human history? Yeah. No. I didn't say that right. The ultimate Greek-Jewish synthesis in human history is... What do you think it is? A very interesting question. Hands down, the ultimate Greek-Jewish synthesis is not kosher souvlaki. Sorry? No. Christianity. Hands down. Christianity is, and as it turned out, the ultimate synthesis of the Greek world, Greco-Roman world, versus Jewish thought. Okay? Albeit in a very modified form. Now, I'm not saying it's just perfect. I'm not saying it's the way the world should be at all. But when we get to talk about Christianity, we'll see there's a very strong influence of both Judaism and Greek thought in Christianity, both in the philosophy of Christianity. If you read people like Thomas Aquinas, people like that, clearly, and much earlier, Augustine, and also in their whole worldview, everything. Very interesting. Yeah? Who? Augustine Aquinas? No, these are later, well, Augustine is a very early Christian thinker. Aquinas is a later medieval Christian thinker. We get... Yeah, well, these are hands down two of the most influential, greatest thinkers in the history of the Christian church. So we'll talk about them a little bit later. Okay, let's a little bit more about, again, you could spend weeks talking about the Maccabees and the revolts and the different battles and who's fighting and who's dying. Just to go through a little of what goes on. Mattathias, who's no youngster, dies during the revolt. He's not killed, he dies. He's just an old man, he dies. Yehuda, who takes over as leader. He's the great military leader. He's the one we talk to as Maccabee, Judas Maccabeus. You know, he's the guy, the real macho hero of the Jewish people. He is also eventually going to be killed. He gets trapped in a vastly outnumbered situation in a battle where he refuses to escape. He makes a stand. He's killed by the Greeks. Eleazar, that other brother, also, he's the guy who runs under the elephant. Okay, thinking the Greek general's in the elephant, he sticks the spear in the elephant's stomach, and the elephant falls down him and crushes him to death, and the general was not even in the elephant. It was one of these like kind of suicide missions to try and take out the command and control center of the Greeks in the hope that they would lose the battle. So he's in a great act of Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name, he gives his name. The three younger brothers, Yochanan, Yonatan, and Shimon, they take over the struggle. Yonatan is murdered. As you can see, the Greeks are pushed more or less out. There's going to be on and off fighting for 25 years. Yonatan is going to be murdered. He's going to be murdered by opponents within the Jewish people, actually. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of enemies of the Jews running around. It's within the Jewish world. It's not like all the Jews, as I mentioned before, all the Jews are on the side of the Jewish people. There's all kinds of conspiracies going on. So too, Shimon is going to also be killed. Okay, often in collusion with the Greeks. We're talking about all kinds of... If you want to read, I don't want to go into all the stories because it's very detailed. The books of the Maccabees, and if you look in a great source, is, again, Flavius Josephus. In his Antiquities and the Jewish Wars, he talks in both books about what's going on at this period of time, because this is all the lead-up to the Romans coming to Israel. They're pretty tragic, the whole family. Now, a guy by the... Shimon, by the way, who's the last of the five brothers to rule. He's the last one to remain alive and the last to rule. All of these guys, Yonatan, Shimon, they're all going to take... They're going to take upon themselves the position of high priest, being Kohanim. And Shimon is going to also take upon himself the title of Ethnarch. Ethnarch is sort of like a king. Which, by the way, he didn't really have the right to do. Because a king is supposed to come from the tribe of Judah, from the house of King David. Which is a bad move on the part of the Maccabees. And it's interesting, if you look at someone like the Ramban, who I think it's in his commentary on Genesis 49, chapter 10, he goes through a whole explanation, which is to a large extent taken from, the Talmud also talks about, that the great tragedy of the Maccabees is that they become corrupted by their own power. Okay, they get into the idea of being kings, which they had no right to be. And even worse than that, we're going to see the later Maccabees, not the original five sons, but the later Maccabean descendants, are going to actually become that which they gave their lives, their ancestors gave their lives to get out of the country, which is Hellenized. So after they go through, like Elazar, Yochanan, Yonatan, Shimon, then we're going to go through the next, a whole series, generations of Maccabean Hasmonean rulers, who are going to rule for a period of 103 years approximately. The next one we have is Yochanan Hyrcanus, John Hyrcanus. Now already you see by their names, they're becoming somewhat Hellenized. They have these Greek-sounding names. Yochanan Hyrcanus is a mighty leader of the Jewish people. He actually expands the borders of Israel during the reign of the Maccabees. Yochanan Hyrcanus, Alexander Yanai, his successor, we're going to see that they're going to build up a Jewish state which is actually quite large, because as Greece is waning, okay, they're going to sort of fill in the vacuum. It's going to be a short-lived period of time, but we're going to have like a mini-Jewish empire similar to what King Solomon has according to Jewish tradition, and David going back much, much earlier in Jewish history. Now, just to fill in a little piece of information, which is very vital to what's going to come next in our story, when Judah Maccabee is leading the revolt against the Greeks, he is going to make a treaty with the Romans. Okay, Rome, as we're going to talk about, which is the topic of our next class, we might begin to get onto it today, but Rome is a rising world power in the second century before the Common Era. As a matter of fact, at that period of time already, they had already absorbed Greece. The Greek Empire had become a Roman province by then. So not that the Jews like the Romans. The Romans are going to end up giving us a lot more, as we say in Yiddish, tsuris, than the Greeks ever did. The Romans are going to give us a much harder time than the Greeks. But that great Arabic expression, my enemy's enemy is my friend, it was an alliance of expedience. Okay? If I have someone threatening me, then I'll make an alliance with that threat's enemy as a way of counteracting the threat. So that's what Judah Maccabee is going to do. And we're going to see that that is going to play itself out later in Jewish history at the end of the reign of the Hasmoneans and the Romans coming to the land of Israel and actually coming to occupy the country. But the seeds of that event are already going to be sown way before the actual event takes place. I'm talking about Pompey coming into Israel in about the year 63 before the Common Era. Okay, so Yochanan Hyrcanus, who's the dates for him, according to most historians, are 135 to 104 BC. Okay, he's going to expand the borders of Israel and do something that is more or less unprecedented. He and Alexander Yanai, his son who follows in his footsteps, they're going to do something which is almost never done in Jewish history. The only examples we know of are during their reigns. They're going to forcibly convert people to Judaism. We don't do this in Judaism. This is something the Christian world did, the Islamic world did, at different periods of time. It is certainly not a Jewish thing, because in Judaism you're supposed to convert because you love truth, and it's difficult, right? We talked about this before. One of the people, and again, when we get to the early period of Roman occupation, are the Idumeans. Who are the Idumeans? The Idumeans, also known as the Edomites, they were people who lived across the Jordan River in the southern part of what is today's Jordan, north of the area of the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aqaba. When the Jews go into exile in the destruction of the First Temple, the Idumeans are going to, since a lot of the area is empty of Jews, they will move across and settle in the southern part of Israel. Has anyone been to a place called Beit Guvrin? It's Beit Guvrin Marasha, which is a really fascinating archaeological site. It's one of the most interesting sites in the whole country. It's got over 2,000 caves that are mostly cut in the limestone. Fascinating place to go and look around. It's not far from Beit Shemesh. It's to the southwest of here. Very interesting site. This was one of the major cities of the Idumeans. Okay? So I take a flashlight, right? It's a great place to go visiting. Archaeological Seminars runs the site, and you can go there and dig for a day, even if you want to be play archaeologist for a day and dig up and get some backache and dirt under your fingernails. Good sunburn. This is one of the areas where almost certainly Yochanan Hyrcanus, John Hyrcanus, and his Jewish army is going to come and cause most of the inhabitants to convert or throw them out of the country. He's going to do this all over his mini-empire. Okay, and one of the families that he's going to almost certainly interact with is a guy by the name, the family of Antipater. And Antipater is going to be very significant also, because we're going to see he's going to be the father of Herod, Herod the Great, a very important character when we can talk about the early Roman period of occupation of the land of Israel. But put that on hold for now. Alexander Yanai, who goes from 103 to 76 BCE, who follows after Yochanan Hyrcanus, is a classic case of Maccabean ruler gone totally off. By this period of time, the Maccabees are siding, they're Hellenized, they're siding with the Sadducees, the Sadducees. They are now against the rabbis. The rabbis initially supported them. The early Maccabean rulers were supported by the rabbis. They were granted the right to be high priest. That position was recognized. Okay. Even when Simon, Shimon, becomes ethnarch, he's also at that period of time given the backing of the rabbis. But later on we see power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. These guys are going to go off. They're going to become very Hellenized. Alexander Yanai, as a matter of fact, is a very interesting person in Jewish literature. He had absolutely no fear of the Sanhedrin or the rabbis. From that, we have this rule that a king does not, lo dan velo din imoto. You don't judge a king, you don't bring him to court. Now, in Jewish law, a king is subject to the law also. But Alexander Yanai is such an arrogant guy, he deliberately, is a great story talking about in Jewish sources where he shows up and he intimidates the Sanhedrin. Come to this, no, except for Shimon ben Shetach, who is the brother-in-law of Alexander Yanai. He's married to Alexander. His sister, Shlomtzion Hamalka, is Alexander Yanai's wife. Except for him, everyone else is cowed by this guy. He has no fear of God. He's not a good Jewish king. And we have a period of tremendous persecution of the Hasmonean rulers going after the rabbis, which is a pattern that's going to be repeated for the rest of the Second Temple period. People like Herod are going to do this all the time. They don't keep Jewish law. They have no fear of God. They have no fear of the Sanhedrin. And things are declining very, very rapidly. And it's a very sad state of affairs, which is why Maimonides says, the Ramban, he says, you know why all these Maccabees, they had like bloody ends and most of them were murdered out and their whole line is killed off? It's because they ended up not being righteous, to say the least. Okay, they end up going off. Okay, there's no descendant of these people left. They're sort of cursed because they're corrupted. Yeah. They became, by the way, this is a classic case of one of the great tragic families, the House of the Hasmoneans, starting off so illustriously and so for the Jewish people and ending so disastrously and bringing the Jewish people to ruin to a large extent. Okay, now, Shlomtzion Hamalka, by the way, who now has a street named after where the post office is in Jerusalem, is a very righteous woman. For a brief period of time, when she is allowed to rule after Alexander Yanai is gone, okay, she restores, with the help of Shimon ben Shetach, her brother, the power of the Sanhedrin and the rabbis. But that's not going to last. It's not going to last at all. As a matter of fact, the last two real Hasmonean rulers who are in place are two guys by the name of Hyrcanus and Aristobulus. Okay, two children of Shlomtzion Hamalka, descendants of Alexander Yanai. Both are totally Hellenized. Okay, Aristobulus is a big follower and supporter of the Sadducees. Hyrcanus is a very weak guy who has a very strong advisor by the name of Antipater, behind him. Antipater is the guy I just mentioned. He's an descendant of Idumean converts to Judaism, who is the father of Herod the Great. Okay, so we have two sort of incompetent brothers who are actually fighting a civil war. Okay, fighting a civil war over who is going to be the next ethnarch king and high priest together. Who's going to have the power? And here's again a classic case of power corrupting. And it's going to end in a terrible disaster, because what are they going to do as a way of trying to see who should be king? They're more or less going to invite the Romans in. Pompey, the great Roman general in the year 63, is going to come to Israel. And he's going to slaughter lots of Jews. And inviting the Romans in was sort of like launching a missile, you know, in a Wedgwood china store. You know, you're going to have a big mess afterwards. You know, a bull in a china shop, whatever. Romans were not people who were into, like, coming quietly and solving problem solving. We're not talking about a multinational peacekeeping force or international mediation here. We're talking about people with an incredible energy to conquer and build their empire. So when Pompey is going to come, he is going to basically decide that Hyrcanus, who's the weaker of the two brothers, he's going to make him the ruler. Why? Because that would make it more easy for Rome to control Israel if the ruler is weak. Okay. And Antipater is going to use that position as Hyrcanus' advisor to get himself into a position of tremendous power. Tremendous power, and it's going to have very negative consequences for the Jewish people. And what's the irony, by the way, of all of this in the end? I'm going to stop in a minute, but I want to... Maccabees. You know, such glorious people. What today is named after the Maccabees? There are soccer teams. Well, the most important there are. There's Maccabi Haifa, Maccabi. There's all the football teams, you know, in Israel. There's in soccer, as we know, in American. Right. But first and foremost, we have beer. That's probably the Greek thing. And the Jewish Olympics, which is a very modern thing. Jewish Olympics is a very modern, you know, post-founding a state of Israel kind of way of Jews being physical and macho like the Gentiles are. I'm nothing against sports, but I'm not knocking sports here. But it is the, you know, the modern state of Israel. When you look at the images that the state of Israel adopts, they seem to have a knack. I don't know who does the PR for this country, but boy, should they be fired. I mean, think about it. The Ministry of Tourism emblem for the state of Israel. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
It's the two guys holding the grapes, the two spies coming back from the land of Israel with a big cluster of grapes. I mean, talk about bad news story in the history of the Jewish people. This is the story where we badmouth the land. We have to wander in the desert and all the men have to die. How's that for a positive image used for the Ministry of Tourism? By the way, tourism stinks so much in this country. You should pick a better image. I mean, it's unbelievable. Who thought of that one? You know, think of anything but that story. It's the worst. To name the Jewish Olympics, and by the way, there's nothing more Greek than Olympics. Olympics is the Greek thing. It's let's run around naked, showing off our perfect bodies and glorifying the physical through sports. Okay? Okay, don't, I'm not, again, I'm not knocking people should be in physical shape. I'm not knocking sports here. But the glorification as an end, this is the macho thing to do, is antithetical to Judaism. To name the Jewish Olympics after the Maccabees, I can't think of any, I mean, it's like naming a synagogue the I Eat Pork Synagogue. You know, it's like, I mean, what an insult to these people. These are people who gave their lives to rid Israel of Greek influence, and as a tribute to them, we take the most Greek thing we could think of and name it after them. I guess it's the ultimate revenge on this poor family that starts so gloriously and ends so ingloriously. But it's one of the great ironies of Jewish history. You know, God definitely has a sense of humor. And by the way, you know, Judaism, Jews, one thing that Jewish people have to have. Golda Meir said it very beautifully. She said, pessimism is an emotion that the Jewish people can't afford to have. And we definitely, as a people, you know, Jews are famous for their sense of humor. Even today, you look at the number of Jews who are stand-up comics. It's unbelievable. You think there's like a billion Jews in the world based on how many Jewish stand-up comics there are. Humor is a very important thing in Jewish history. And to get through the very difficult history we have to be able to laugh at ourselves and the situation that we find ourselves in. But certainly this is one of the more interesting ironies, I would say, in the history of the Jewish people. And it's certainly not the only one. Okay. Let's stop here. Again, I highly recommend, there's a lot more that can be said on this topic especially. Go get a copy of the Book of the Maccabees, or go get Josephus. He gives all the gory details and all the machinations and palace plots going on at this time. I'm not going to be here for the next 3 days. I think you have a class, I don't think you have vacation. We'll pick it up on Thursday with what is one of my favorite topics in Jewish history, which is Roman Empire.